Okay. So I guess we'll get started. First of all, thank you guys all for coming out. We've been, you know, working on this week of education for a while, and we're basically just a group of students who are really interested in building a community of activists on campus. And we believe that the first step to that is becoming educated on the issues, and then, you know, coming up with ways to tackle those issues. So, you know, historically, San Francisco State has a long history of activism, and we think that we need to continue that, especially with what's going on, especially with the war situation in Palestine and in other places. And that said, I'd like to introduce our speaker. This is Iyad Tishawi from the Free Palestine Alliance, and he's just going to give us some information on Zionism and on the situation.
Well, good evening. I would like to, first of all, thank the students here who have been very, very active on not just Palestine, but all issues of social justice. And I think when we think of Palestine, it's extremely important to situate it within the global context of what social justice is, and within the movement of achieving a global system of social justice, especially within the framework of globalization today, and the consolidation of wealth, consolidation of power, and militarism. And so, what I hope to do today is not focus so much on the political situation, but try to establish a little bit more of a framework for discourse over Zionism, and what Zionism is from the perspective of the oppressed, from the perspective of the indigenous Palestinian people, in terms of what it represents for the Palestinian people, how it was constructed historically, and how it developed into the current state of Israel as we know it today. The title of the talk that I was asked to discuss was that Zionism is racism, which brings to my mind Resolution 3379, United Nations Resolution 3379 of 1975, said that Zionism is a form of racism and racial discrimination, which I think in many ways, and most analysts at the time, concurred that it was a simplistic resolution. The reason why it was simplistic, because it focused only on the racist aspect of Zionism and took it outside of the context of a settler colonial movement that meant to establish an Israeli state that is non-Arab on an Arab Palestine with indigenous people living there. So when we discuss racism within the context of the United States, for example, one of the things that, at least the images that are evoked in my mind, is a poem called Strange Fruit that was turned into a song that Billie Holiday sang at a certain point, that really evokes the images of segregation, Jim Crow, lynching, all the results of slavery that resulted in the segregation of African Americans from the white societies so that to maintain economic advantage of the white society. For many of us Palestinians, especially like myself, who I grew up in Lebanon, to me the image is not an image of lynching per se, but it's more of two images. On one side of it is F-16s, really the bottom of F-16s, since we don't have any F-16s to fly, but we tend to see them from the bottom as they're dropping bombs on us. And then the other image is the image of Sabra and Shatila, a very famous massacre of the Palestinian refugees that took place in 1982. So, what is Zionism from the Palestinian perspective? Zionism really constitutes colonialism, dispossession, forced displacement, collective punishment, and segregation. And so all of these aspects of Zionism that result in the material oppression of Palestinians have a racist component in them. And so a settler colonial movement is racist if the settler colonial movement aspires to be European within a third world context, disregarding the historical continuity and the cultural continuity of the land that it occupies. So let's move away a little bit from looking at Israel as it stands today and look at some of the basics of the development of Zionist theory and Zionist ideology, starting with the author of the Jewish State, Theodor Herzl, who really was very much affected by many factors. One of them was the real presence of anti-Semitism in Europe. And in response to the Dreyfus affair in France, when a Jewish person by the name of Dreyfus was humiliated in France, and there was a huge outcry because of the anti-Semitic treatment of that person, who started arguing for a segregationist kind of mentality around Jews, saying that Jews and Gentiles can no longer coexist, they can no longer live together, and so what Jews required is a Jewish state. And he argued in 1905, quote, "to go further than any colonialist has gone in Africa, where involuntary expropriation of land will temporarily alienate civilized opinion. By the time the reshaping of world opinion in our favor has been completed, we shall be firmly established in our country, no longer fearing the influx of foreigners and receiving our visitors with aristocratic benevolence." So, as you can see right from the get-go, right from 1905, the Zionist ideology that aspired for the creation of a Jewish state on Palestine did have a colonial goal in mind, and that colonial goal meant the involuntary expropriation of land. And that really lays the historical basis, not only for the creation of Israel in 1948, but until this very day with the construction of settlement colonies within the West Bank and Gaza, the forced expulsion of Palestinians, the military occupation, and the policies that you see today. Again, the points that I would like to focus on in terms of Zionism is the colonial character, the character of collective punishment and dispossession, and the character of forced displacement. Rabin, who's considered to be one of the peacemakers of Israel, is himself a segregationist, and he viewed peace in a book that was written by Shimon Peres called The New Middle East. He viewed peace as a formula of separating the indigenous Palestinians from the Jewish people, from the Jewish immigrants to Palestine. And that is by establishing a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza on less than 22% of historic Palestine. And he said, quote, I want to maintain the character of my state and the character of my Knesset. What he was really arguing is that Israel ought to remain a Jewish state and a Jewish-only state. And that is done by maintaining demographic superiority of the Jewish immigrants into Palestine, by expelling the Palestinians and keeping them expelled and giving them their own state, then Israel can maintain its Jewish character. The only problem with that argument is that not all Palestinians have been expelled. There are about 1 million Palestinians that live within the borders of Israel, within the 1948 Green Line. It is estimated that by 2020, there will be demographic parity between the Palestinians and the Jewish immigrants to Israel. So what that means is that demographic parity will ultimately set the stage for yet another political campaign for yet another expulsion. And I'll go into that a little bit later. Another thing that really characterizes some of the expansionist aspect of the colonial policies of Zionism, as they have been manifested and materialized, is the policy of massacres. Going back to the massacre of Deir Yassin in 1948, Qibya in 1953, Sabra and Shatila in 1982, and Jenin just recently. And the reason why massacres are really important, and particularly Deir Yassin, where 256 people were killed, Deir Yassin is really important because Menachem Begin, who is who was at the time the leader of a paramilitary organization called the Stern Gang, boasted by saying that Deir Yassin set the stage for the expulsion of the Palestinian people, because there were so many violations of Deir Yassin at that time. And for the Zionists to go into Palestine and say, not only that we're here to occupy the land, but we are here to displace you. And this is one very important distinction between the classical colonial movements as we knew them, for example, in Algeria, in South Africa, in many places in Africa, in India, and Israel as a settler colonial movement that is dispossessing and displacement. Because Israel does not intend to colonize and exploit the Palestinians. Israel intends to colonize Palestine and remove the Palestinians, expel the Palestinians out of Palestine in order to maintain that demographic superiority. So the chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces in 1983, after the massacre of Sabra and Shatila, he said, quote, "We declare openly that the Arabs have no right to settle on even 1 centimeter of Eretz Israel. Forces all they do or ever will understand. We shall use the ultimate force until the Palestinians come crawling to us on all fours." So, not only that you have a policy of institutionalized policy within the administrative government, within the legal system, within the economic system of segregation and superiority, but you also have a military policy to back all of that up. And the military policy is to use the policies of massacres at some points, policies of occupation at other points, in order to maintain that separation between the Jewish immigrants and the Palestinian people. And that kind of ideology must result in the racist outlook. Because in order to separate yourself from the indigenous people, you have to argue that you are more superior than the indigenous people because you have certain unique qualities that the indigenous people don't have. And so you have to dehumanize the enemy in order to justify in your mind why you ought to treat them as such. Why do the Palestinians need to come crawling on all four? So all kinds of quotes, you know, from Menachem Begin stating that the Palestinians are beasts walking on two legs. We must do everything to ensure that the Palestinians never return, and so on and so forth. So these are the opinion makers of the Israeli state. These are the people who set the stage for what we know today as Israel. They fought in the wars that have been really considered as really important worlds in the cultural composition and the cultural construction of Israel. And so they have ultimate credibility when they state things like that. There's another military concept also called the rational prospect. And what the rational prospect does, and this was also developed by another Zionist dove, Ben-Gurion, it targets civilians in order to isolate the civilian from the guerrilla. Because it has been understood that Israel is not in a war against a particular government. Israel is not in a war against the government of Palestine because there has been no government of Palestine. Israel is in a war of expansion against a people who are not necessarily armed or who don't necessarily have parity of force. And at some points they are armed. And they have been organized into militias, they have been organized into guerrillas throughout the rise of the PLO in the 1970s and the 1980s. And so in order to isolate these resistance forces, the Rational Prospect argues that one must target the civilian population of the Palestinian people so as to place a very large burden on the Palestinian population so that they will no longer host people who are resisting with force against the Israeli expansion, against the massacres, against these forms of dehumanization. The other important aspect of Zionism, as not just as a colonial movement, but as a displacing colonial movement, is that you have to acquire the land, and then you have to argue that this is the maintenance of a biblical continuity, that you have a biblical legitimacy to be there, that you were there 2,000 years ago, and because you were there 2,000 years ago, that interruption in the history of continuity is an anomaly, and what is normal is for the European Jewish people, as well as other Jewish people, to immigrate into the land of Palestine and claim it from the indigenous people and displace them. And so in order to do that and maintain that continuity, you have to change the character of the land. You have to change the names of the cities, the names of the villages. In 1948, 485 villages and towns were completely destroyed. Palestinian towns were completely erased off the face of the map. And two-thirds of the Palestinian population were expelled from Palestine. And Moshe Dayan, in his address to Technion University in 1969, he said, quote, "Jewish villages were built in the place of Arab villages. You do not even know the names of these Arab villages, and I do not blame you because geography books no longer exist. Not only do the books not exist, the Arab villages are not there either. Nahlal arose in the place of Mahlul. Kibbutz Gvat in the place of Jibta. Kibbutz Sarid in the place of Genephis. And Kafar Yehusha in the place of Tal Shuman. There is not a single place built in this country that did not have a former Arab population." So here you have recognition by the leaders that yes, indeed, this is a colonial project on an indigenous land. We have expelled the indigenous people, but we also want to change the character of the land to turn it from something that was Arab, something that was Palestinian, something that maintained its historical continuity within a larger Arab context, where today, for example, there are 300 million Arabs that live in the Arab world, and Palestine is part and parcel of that, historically and culturally, to something that is not part and parcel of it, to something that is foreign, to something that's non-indigenous, to something that's colonial, to something that's artificially constructed. So in order to change the cultural character, you need the cultural ideological basis to do that. And that requires sometimes in the fabrication of certain myths. One of the most important myths to encourage European Jewish immigration to Palestine was to advertise Palestine as an empty country, to say that this is, we want to construct a Jewish state on a land without a people, for a people without a land. That we as Jews are part of a nationality, a nation, and that we want to immigrate into the land of Palestine because it's empty. And so we're not really forcing anybody out. This is absolutely justified. Now, the majority of the Jewish public at the time, up until 1938 or so, up until the beginning of World War II, have looked at this idea and they outright rejected it. Mainly it meant that because they would have to leave their setting where they live and immigrate into somebody else's country where it was well known that, yes, indeed it was populated, that any kind of project like this was yet another colonial project, and it was the time when colonialism has peaked and it was about to recede. By the 1950s and the 1960s, the majority of the world was beginning to decolonize. Another myth that was really important later on, after the establishment of the state, was that Israel made the desert bloom. That when Israel was constructed. It was constructed on an empty desert with swamps that was infested with diseases and malaria in this empty land. And yet they brought in civilization with their colonial European project. They improved the place. They elevated it. And now the desert is actually blooming. You go in there, you see the farm fields, you see the agriculture. Well, if you take Jaffa oranges, for example, and I always like to give this example because I come from that lineage. My mother's family is from Jaffa. My grandfather and my mother's family was one of the owners of many of the fields, the orange fields in Jaffa, many of the orange orchards over there. And today, Jaffa oranges stand as a prime example of how Israel made the desert bloom. And what that really means is that people like my family were expelled, their farms were taken over, they were stolen, and now they were given into private hands. First of all, they were under the control of the state, and then they were sold into private hands. And that meant that Jaffa oranges stand as one of the prides of Israel, of the agricultural production of Israel. Yet, it has always been there within Palestinian hands, and that there's no acknowledgement there. The other myth is that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. In order to build such a democracy, you need to qualify that democracy. Yes, indeed, people vote who carry the Israeli passports, and there is a parliamentary system, and there is a government where the prime minister gets elected. That's right. However, in order to enter into the parliament and become a political party that's recognized by the parliament, you have to first and foremost state that you recognize Israel as a Jewish-only state, that this is a Jewish-only state. It doesn't have a constitution, which means that if in the future there is demographic parity, that also gives the right for Israel to change the laws at any given point fundamentally in order to dispossess the Palestinians even further.
Can I ask a quick question about that?
Let me continue and then I'll wrap it up really soon. And in order to maintain this semblance of Jewish democracy within Israel, and nobody argues that there is a democracy in Israel, but it's the democracy for Jews only because it's a Jewish only nation. And today, the 2/3 of the population that were expelled constitute 5.5 million. So the total Palestinian population is 8.5 million people. 2 million live in the West Bank and Gaza. They don't have the right to vote. They do not have the right to vote. That is one of the aspects of how much of a contradiction this claim to democracy is. The 1 million Palestinians who live in Israel have to declare that Israel is a Jewish-only state. They don't have the right to acquire and buy land. There is a law that was constructed by the Jewish National Fund that declares that identifies the Jewish nationality, and the Jewish nationality has first rights to land and it has first right to return. This means that any person who identifies oneself as Jewish can go and immigrate into Palestine, get immediate citizenship. And yet the Palestinians who are indigenous to the land, even if they carry Israeli passports, they cannot acquire land. If they don't carry Israeli passports and they have been expelled as part of the refugees who live in the refugee camps, according to Resolution 194, the Palestinians who were expelled in 1948 and later on in 1967 have the right to return to live in their towns and villages and live as equals, like the Jewish immigrants who live there at the moment. But they are not granted that right, yet any person living in Brooklyn or in Chicago or in Poland or in Germany or in Moscow can immigrate if they can prove that they are Jewish. They can go into Palestine. They get first dibs on the land. They get subsidized to live inside Jewish-only settlements that are constructed in the West Bank and Gaza. Again, against international law, and for these settlements to maintain their Jewish-only character, they have roads that are assigned only for the residents of these settlements. And so if you're a Palestinian, you can't use these roads. You have to take very dangerous bypass roads at some times. Of course, I'm not going to get into the military occupation because everybody here hears about it and understands how racist it is, how brutal it is, in terms of the starting from the Iron Fist policy until this very day that resulted in some of the gravest atrocities like Jenin and others. But what I'm going to...
That is so symbolic. Wow.
So, what I'm going to get into is the policy that separates the Palestinians even among themselves. The policy of siege around every town, around every city, not only in the 1967 territories, but also within the 1948, within the Green Line, within Israel. Many of the Arab villages have been removed off the map, and then the Israeli state claims that these villages and towns are actually, not only that they don't exist, but they belong to nomads. There is no way that these Palestinians can somehow prove their residency, or their deeds to the land. So the Palestinians bring their deeds forward, and the Israeli state claims that we cannot really recognize these deeds because they were set up and they were ratified by the British colonial rule prior to the establishment of the State of Israel. And so we have the right to displace you at any given time. And that happened in Umm al-Fahim, it happened in other cities within the 1948. Haifa is a great example of how Palestinians who live there apply for permits repeatedly to reconstruct their homes, to renovate their homes, and these permits are denied. And in many cases, these homes get destroyed because sometimes they violate the law and they go ahead and they renovate because they've been living under this kind of rule for 53 years now and they have to do that. And so the retaliation is usually that the Israeli police force comes in and destroys the addition to the house or the house itself sometimes. So there is continuous displacement even within the 1948. There's continuous displacement outside of the 1967. And the attempt is to shift the discourse today from that Jewish-only character of the state to that of Israeli policy. That what we need to discuss is not whether Israel is a racist state. It's not whether Israel and the ideology of Zionism is that of a colonial construction. But what we need to discuss is how to end the occupation, where to draw the border, and to what degree we can compromise land to the Palestinians. So, again, you move from one form of segregation to another form of segregation, and the Palestinians end up living in ghettos. And there's a new definition that's being introduced right now to the world, is that Palestine is only the West Bank and Gaza, and that Palestinians are only the residents of the West Bank and Gaza. And so they have completely erased the identity of 1 million people living inside 1948. They call them Israeli Arabs. Mm-hmm. And they're lost among 300 million other Arabs. And the identity of people like us, the 5.5 million Palestinians who have been forced into exile. The last one, and this is a really important one for many progressive Jews in the world, is particularly within the United States construction and the United States public sphere of debate and discourse, and that is Israel exists because the Holocaust occurred. The Holocaust was the final example of how Jews and non-Jews can no longer live together, and that's why we need to create the State of Israel. And so, one needs to truly understand that what happened in the Holocaust was a gigantic atrocity. And it was a gigantic atrocity of the most appalling and disgusting proportions. And one needs to understand and contextualize that as such. However, what is happening today, in the name of all of the Jewish community and all of the people who have suffered anti-Semitism and have suffered these kinds of atrocities, under the banner of Israel, of trying to construct a Jewish-only state, is also another atrocity. And I think that's where the discourse ought to become. The discourse needs to start among conscious Jews within the United States to truly begin re-examining what Zionism represents to them when it speaks in their name. The same way that a minority group in Germany rose to power and spoke in the name of all Germans and militarized the whole society, recruited the whole society into committing massive atrocities, not only against Jews, but against Russians, against Gypsies, against gays, against all kinds of people. And tens of millions of people were lost during that time. Lives were destroyed. Societies were destroyed. And today, we're seeing a society that's being destroyed in front of us, and that is the Palestinian society. Under the pretext that Israel needs to exist as a Jewish-only state because of the Holocaust. I think these two issues need to be separated. The historical contexts are very different, and the ideological constructions are very different. In fact, if one goes back to some of the Warsaw ghetto uprisings and some of the developments during the Nazi atrocities against Jews, one can see two trends. First and foremost is that the Zionist forces within the Jewish resistance were trying to encourage Jews not to fight and stay there, but to try to get to Israel as fast as possible, and to really work political agreements with England and the United States to encourage the migration into Palestine. And there have been ships of refugees coming from Europe at that time into the United States, and because of American anti-Semitism and American racism, they shipped them back there to die in Europe, so that they can give the Zionists yet another card to encourage the migration and give no other alternative for the Jewish Europeans but to immigrate into Palestine. So there has been a use of a historical atrocity against a people in order to justify yet another atrocity, and that is the colonial construct of Israel in the way it exists today. And so it's really important to deconstruct that myth, think about it very carefully, and not to jump to conclusions when one says that Israel exists because of the Holocaust as a Jewish-only state. I'm going to end with this quote that really evokes an image very much like strange fruit. This is an image from many of the histories and the development and the social development of the Palestinian youth as you see them today. This quote was by a Japanese journalist, photojournalist, who went into Sabra and Shatila, who attempted to go into Sabra and Shatila several times. And she was stopped by the Israeli military as the Israeli proxies, local militias who were trained and paid and by Israel, who were conducting the massacre. She was turned away, and then ultimately she was able to sneak in. And at the time, I'll read you the quote. Quote, "I arrived at the garden of a house where I found all members of a family massacred. It looked as if a bulldozer had attempted to hide the corpses. The dead body of a child of about 2 years old was thrown beside the rubble. I imagined that it was alive until the very end, as the corpse was not hidden under the bulldozed rubble by the killers. In the next alley, I found the bodies of two more children, a girl and a boy, both around 5 years old. Near them, a woman's body, probably their mother, was covered with the rubble by a bulldozer. The rubble did not completely cover her, and some parts of her body could be seen. The girl was wearing a toy earring. The boy was wearing something like a chain around his neck. He seemed to have been choked by that chain, as his neck seemed to have swollen with congested blood. These are 5-year-old children who were massacred as part of 4,500 people that were massacred during a period of 6 days. 3 of those days were concentrated on Sabra and Shatila, and 3 were concentrated outside of Sabra and Shatila. More and more evidence is being uncovered right now of Ariel Sharon, the current Prime Minister of Israel, who was the head of the defense forces at the time, who led the invasion into Lebanon. That's being presented in Belgian court under a law that allows people to sue in civil courts for damages for these kinds of war crimes. The United States and Israel have done everything to stall such kinds of claims, not only in the world court, but also in Belgium. And it is not a coincidence that at the time, Menachem Begin, as I said earlier, was the prime minister who led that invasion into Lebanon, who was also brought up and developed politically to value massacres as an important political tool in order to, one, conduct a rational prospect policy, and that is to separate the civilian from the guerrilla by attacking the civilian and massacring the civilian and not giving the surrounding environment to support the guerrilla, and two, to encourage the Palestinian population en masse to learn in the language of massacres, like the previous quotes. So, in my conclusion, if one looks at the current intifada and contextualizes that as a rebellion against colonialism, where 40,000 Palestinians have been injured and maimed. And I really want to start with the injured and the maimed a lot more than the killed, because it is the injured and the maimed who are going to reflect the social fabric of tomorrow's society, the social fabric that not only Palestine has to contend with, but also the Israeli public, the Israeli people, the American people, the world population, have to contend with. 40,000 people in out of 2 million people is a very large number to be permanently disabled or maimed in such an attack against the civilian population. 1,700 killed, and 5.5 million Palestinians continue to live in exile, calling on the world community, on all progressive people in the world, to say, look, what we want is as simple as what happened in South Africa. One person, one vote, and not to maintain the demographic superiority of one people at the cost of destroying another society. That's all I have.
So now we'll open up the floor for questions.
I believe, according to is there Golda Meir, who I believe is from Milwaukee, if I'm not mistaken, she was quoted as saying when she was prime minister that there was not really any Palestinian national identity before 1948. And my question to you is if you could discuss the idea, like, of what is a Palestinian, and is that true? Like, did the Palestinians, did that term form after 1948, or was there always, like, a Palestinian identity within that region where people identified themselves as being Palestinian?
Palestinian identity was really important. Starting from the year, I would say, of 980. What was more important than Palestinian identity was the regionalism, mainly because the societal construction and the stratification of leadership, the way the society governed itself, was according to region. If you were from Tyre, you didn't identify yourself as Lebanese, you identified yourself as Tyre, you're from Tyre in Lebanon. If you're from Jerusalem, you identified yourself as a person of Jerusalem from Palestine. If you're from Haifa, again, person from Haifa in Palestine. That became more and more important starting with the Ottoman rule. Because the Ottomans really reshaped and reorganized Palestinian society as well as the rest of their colonial subject society into something that's much larger than mini city-states, but into greater city-states. The question is, what is a nation-state? And how do you define nationalism here? The whole concept of a state that was built along a single national identity was an imported colonial concept that was imposed on the Palestinian and the Arab people like everybody else. It was imposed by France on its colonial subjects and by Britain on us as colonial subjects. The way we lived is, first of all, we are Arabs. We lived in our towns and cities and villages. We had particular traditions that were particular to the region of Palestine, particular dances associated with cultivation, with fishing, traditions, particular beliefs, and so on and so forth, that were particular to the land of Palestine. So the Golda Meir's claim was even more drastic than that. She actually claimed that the Palestinians did not exist. And then later on, she conceded that Palestinians actually hated themselves. No, Palestinians liked themselves less than they hated the Israelis. And if they started liking themselves, then there would be some form where Israel can continue to exist peacefully. At the time that where massive atrocities were being committed against the Palestinian people. So the concept, I think this is one of the major myths of Israel, that Palestinian national identity did not exist. It did exist. The problem with that also is that when you legislate in your legal system a particular religion as a nationality, when you say, it doesn't matter what you believe in, what matters to me is that if you can prove to me that you're part of a particular religion or your ancestors are part of a particular religion, then you are a national. And I will give you first rights to this state, and I will give you first right protection within this state in order to completely erase the nationality of the indigenous people and then rewrite history and introduce a new narrative that says Palestinian national identity is artificial, it's constructed, it's only a reaction to the establishment of the State of Israel.
Interesting. She was from Milwaukee, though, wasn't she?
I don't know exactly where she was from. Okay. She was not from the region. There's one also very important aspect about Israeli society as it stands today. In the year 2002, not the way it stood in the 1980s or 1990s. There are many, many Mizrahi Jews, Arab Jews, who really were fundamental in the construction of Israel, who were encouraged, in part, really by Israel, to immigrate into Israel. One of the most famous operations that were conducted by the Mossad was Operation Magic Carpet in Iraq, where they bombed a synagogue in Iraq in order to create an atmosphere of fear for the Jewish population in Iraq so that they would migrate into Palestine. Now, that same Jewish population, and particularly the Iraqi and the Moroccan population, are extremely discriminated against within Israel. They're Jews, just like the people who are in power. But that goes to show you that this colonial project, the Zionist state, it is not constructed to serve the Jewish people as much as it is constructed to serve the white people. And so if you look at the way society is constructed, who's in power and who has been in power ever since the creation up until today. How many Arab Jews have been in power? How many Ethiopian Jews have been in power? There have been a massive outcry within Israeli society itself, because they would not take any blood, donated blood, from Ethiopian Jews, because it's considered to be contaminated or dirty blood or diseased. In addition to that, most of these Ethiopians who were airlifted during famine, Israel decided to airlift only the Jewish Ethiopians and leave everybody else to die in the famine. I mean, that gives you a little bit of a framework of how Israel not only views the Palestinians and the Arabs, even if you want to take that out of the debate, what kind of society is being constructed that is stratified not only along ethnic and theocratical lines, but also along color within the construction of Israel.
Given everything that you've just said, it sounds to me like you really don't believe that there is a place for a Jewish national state, any kind of Jewish self-determination, certainly not in the Middle East, where apparently it should be all Arab or Muslim. How do you see any kind of solution coming about if there isn't really, if you don't see any legitimacy for having a Jewish state at all? How do you see there becoming any kind of peace or resolution?
I believe, and like the Palestinian national movement has been arguing since 1965 until this very day, that every people have a right to self-determination, including the Jewish immigrants into Palestine. They have the right to self-determination. However, that does not mean that Israel in its current model is the right solution. It's not the right solution for its people, and it's not the right solution for the indigenous people, mainly because they are constructing a state that's for Jews only, according to a monolithic definition of what Judaism is. In one way or another, one can even argue, and as many Jewish scholars have argued, that this is becoming more of a slander on what Judaism is. Who gets to determine? Is it Ariel Sharon who's going to determine whether you're Jewish or not, and whether you have the right to self-determination or not? Or is it you who needs to argue that according to how you identify yourself? So there is a fundamental...
You have a pretty broad way of looking at who is Jewish.
Yeah.
It's not
Ariel Sharon?
The government. The way that it's decided. They just,
there has
also
been a
just
huge
decided recently
debate.
That converts through reform and conservative can also come in.
Yeah.
It's not so monolithic.
There has been a huge debate over the past 3 or 4 years about whether particular sectors of Jewish society are accepted as authentically Jewish or not. And you may know a little bit more about that than I do, but I know, for example, that reform is very questionable within the eyes of the Jewish state, and that also implies that for Jews who may identify as Jewish, whether they have the same right to acquisition of this involuntarily expropriated land from the Palestinians and be able to acquire it similar to anybody else who is white, who's Orthodox, and so on and so forth. So, in our perspective, the Jewish people who have immigrated into Palestine, who have, within the under the policies of the State of Israel, who have benefited tremendously from expropriation of land, we can recognize their need for self-determination. But that does not mean that we recognize the need for a Jewish-only state at the cost of having 5.5 million Palestinians living in exile and 3 million Palestinians living in conditions that are very close to slavery.
I have a problem with why you say Jewish-only consistently, though, because there are Arab members of the Knesset, Arab Israelis can vote, so, and they're certainly not trying to expel Arabs that are living in Israel.
There has been, I don't know if you want to moderate this discussion, I'm willing to continue. There has been, if you look at Azmir Bshara, for example, Azmir Bshara is a typical Arab member of the Knesset, whose diplomatic immunity has been lifted, mainly because he argued that if you're under occupation, you have the right to resist occupation, because occupation is illegal under international law. and he's being persecuted by the Israeli state. He's been beaten. There was a mob of people who went to his house, and the Israeli state never provided any protection for him. This is a member of parliament. This is not the average Joe on the street.
But he is a member and, of parliament, and they the only, there. So how is it Jewish?
The only way, the
how
only
is,
way he got
I'm
to
trying
become,
to understand how is it
the
Jewish
only way he got to become.
If Arabs are able to yeah. vote, they go to university. Let they
no,
can
no,
participate
Arabs,
in parliament.
No,
yes,
Arab,
I went to Hebrew University.
Two,
I saw plenty of
two,
Arab Israelis.
Two million Palestinians who live under occupation do not have the right to vote. They still live right now under
Israeli.
They voted
Israeli. For Arafat.
They live under.
They have a right to vote.
They live under Israeli rule.
Why doesn't their government? Why doesn't the Palestinian Authority respond?
For 30 years, they've been paying taxes for Israel, and Israel has not returned a single penny to them. All that has returned to them are Apache helicopters, Merkava tanks, and the destructions of their towns and villages. And that's really an important factor to remember. The 1 million Palestinians who they're not Israeli Arabs. They don't identify themselves as Israeli Arabs. They identify themselves as Palestinians, and Israel does not identify them as Israeli nationals. It identifies them as Israeli citizens, because Israel's definition of nationality is a racist one. It says, if you're not Jewish, you're not an Israeli national. In the United States, if I carry the American passport, I'm an American national. I have the same protection as anybody else. If I go get stuck in war somewhere, and I get airlifted, I have the right to be airlifted and saved by my government like anybody else if I were an American citizen. That is not the case in the very definition of what an Israeli national is.
So in your opinion, what's the difference between a national and a citizen?
There is a distinction according to the state of Israel of what an Israeli national and a citizen is.
One second, can you keep the question to hand raising because I just want to kind of kill.
Yeah,
he just wasn't looking at me. Sorry.
She's moderating it, so
yeah.
Let her know if you want to speak.
So, in short, we believe in everybody's right for self-determination, but we don't believe in the colonization of our land, in the expropriation of our land as continues to this very day, and the expulsion of our people, and the mass killing of our people, in order to maintain demographic superiority of a single people over another, especially if they're not indigenous.
I just have a question about this whole concept of one vote, one person, and you use South Africa as an example. And I was just sitting here thinking that although South Africa, there's one vote per one person, the indigenous Africans are still oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not as though there's one vote for one person and they got their land back. It's not as though it's one vote for one person and people are not still oppressed, people are not living in slums, there's not a major class difference. Those who have and those who have not. So I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit to, and I'm assuming that that's not what you're talking about, people being oppressed, you know, the haves and the have-nots, but in regards to this whole concept of one vote, one person, are you looking at, say, a large Palestinian state where one vote, one person, whether you're, you know, Jewish or Israeli or you're Palestinian, or what exactly are you looking at like that? Because, you know, I don't necessarily know that it worked in South Africa. Look at what's going on in Zimbabwe. It didn't work there either, so.
Yes, and what happened in South Africa is a problem, yet it's a lot less of a problem
right.
than apartheid.
Right.
Because liberation comes in increments.
Right.
It may not necessarily come overnight.
Right.
There has to be a shift, not only in the discourse, but in the consciousness of the people who are oppressed and the people who are oppressing them, that equality is for the benefit of the whole of society. And that consensus has not been established in South Africa yet.
Mm-hmm.
And there are more troubles on the horizon for the South African people, and you can begin to see them manifesting.
Mm-hmm.
But they're different problems than apartheid in its most abhorrent and sordid way that it was established. What we have in Palestine is something that is a little bit worse than apartheid, because on a continuous basis we're being displaced off of our land, we're being pushed off into oblivion. It's truly a war against oblivion in that sense. And so if the trend continues, within 10-15 years there will be no more Palestinian people. It will be a complete sociocide, or you can call it a slow genocide, really, against the Palestinian people. And so the question falls on the international community to try to address this and to see whether, first of all, they want to sit there quietly, and especially the American public, and continue subsidizing Israel with $6 billion a year, or take action, say that the end of apartheid is the first step towards liberation, and then the second step towards liberation is creating an economic model where there is a redistribution of wealth, redistribution of resources, where the European immigrants and the indigenous people can live as equal. Because I think that separation of wealth also exists between the Arab Jews and the non-Arab Jews. From our perspective, there are layers of oppression.
Right.
And the Arabs are the bottom layer, and then above that comes the Arab-Jewish layer and the African-Jewish layer. And then above that, you know, there are the Sephardic Jews and then the Ashkenazis. And this is a very stratified society. The same way South Africa was stratified between white and colored and black. Because once you practice one form of racism, you practice all forms of racism. So breaking down, first of all, these barriers along ethnic and religious lines is very important. And then the economic and social barriers come next.
I know that a lot of the Arab states in the Middle East came to be out of colonialism. So do you believe that states such as Jordan should be decolonized and be given back to the indigenous people as well?
Well, I believe that Jordan and the majority of the Arab regimes today are not accountable to their people. They're accountable to the U.S. And had they been accountable to their people, first of all, there would be no monarchies. And secondly, they would have supported the Palestinians in the face of this massacre that's taking place.
Yeah, could you elaborate on the biblical rationalization for Zionism?
Well, it's the Zionists argue that this is the promised land. It's the return of the kingdom of David. And there needs to be established that there ought to be a Jewish continuity where the kingdom of David was established. Because it's the promised land, it's the return to Zion, and there are many references to that in the Old Testament. The dangerous part is not this. The dangerous part is that the evangelical church in the United States, which has been historically anti-Semitic, it has allied itself with the most racist institutions, argues that if the kingdom of David fully is established and consolidated, and if the Jewish people go back to Palestine, then it will be the first stage for the wiping out of this whole civilization, the Jewish civilization that's being constructed, and the return of the Messiah. And it is for that reason that you find the evangelical church taking a new line, probably starting from the late 80s until today, in supporting Zionism and Israel and everything that's Zionist, even though they're very much anti-Semitic. So I think there is a struggle to be fought even within the theocratical institutions here in the United States to enlighten the public on what the evangelical church is advocating for, what its history has been with regards to Jews and with regards to different communities here within the United States, and what and how it perceives the conflict. I'm personally not a biblical scholar, so I can't really tell you much more than that. But it's anybody who knows the Bible.
To continue on that, I'm still trying to understand. Is Zionism, does it come from the roots of Judaism, or is it an ideology that was created during, say, the last couple hundred years of driving towards an Israeli state?
The Zionism was pretty much consolidated in the year 1898. It's a secular ideology that was created among people of Jewish descent by a group of right-wing scholars who allied themselves with the colonial movements at the time, in particular Britain. that and France that facilitated the immigration of the Jewish community out of Europe and into Palestine, and they viewed themselves as a colonial project that would coordinate with the colonial rulers at the time. Eventually, there was a contradiction between the Zionist movement and Britain, and they collided because Britain wanted to maintain control, the Zionists wanted to establish the State of Israel. But yet, that relationship evolved. Balfour, for example, Lord Balfour, who proposed the partition of Palestine in 1917, he himself was an anti-Semite. And in his mind, the Jews being in Palestine is much better than the Jews being in England. Because so there was, in a sense, a convergence of right-wing ideologies between the leaders of Zionism, which was a secular movement at the time, and the anti-Semitic movements in Europe. Similarly, today, like with the evangelical church, you see an intersection of interest, or with George Bush. I mean, if you look at the Republican Party or Bush Sr., Bush Sr. had Nazis on his cabinet, on his campaign. And people who were running his campaign, there was a huge scandal, if you go back and look at some of the reports, of having neo-Nazis who had ties to neo-Nazis organization. Mm-hmm. And then he had to step forward and apologize and fire them off. But yet, Bush Jr., who's continuing the same policies as Bush Sr., calls Sharon a man of peace and says that the State of Israel is defending itself against terror. And the occupation in its current state is acceptable for the United States and for Bush Jr. So that all of these are indications that Zionism is not necessarily a religiously based movement, but it is a colonial construction that has economic manifestations and economic goals, and it has allied itself with colonial powers in the past.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that comment. It kind of goes into a lot of other stuff that Yada talked about. I think that there's kind of a myth that we learned that at the turn of the century, Zionism was the only contestable Jewish political force in Europe during the time. But actually, that wasn't true at all. Like, it was at first a very, very small force that actually was in opposition to a lot of what was going on, especially during the World War I period. There was the Bundist movement, which was a Jewish nationalist socialist movement that worked with other communist and socialist organizations all throughout Europe. A lot of people involved in that movement came to the United States and organized during that time period. And this trajectory existed until the 1940s, until World War II. So you have like horrendously contradictory situations where the ghetto fights take place, you know, and you know, I'm not exactly sure of the timing. It might be off a little bit, but also, you know, at the beginning of World War II, there was an instance of the World Zionist Organization actually corresponding with Hitler, right? So I think that that's really important history to look at, because like you learn that Zionism, even as a secular political force, okay, what other alternatives were there? And there were other alternatives that were in opposition to Zionism a lot of the time, from the time of its formation until World War II.
So, and to add on that, There has been a huge victory on the part of the United States and Israel ever since there has been a construction of a unipolar superpower in the world and complete domination of the United Nations. First of all, with the reversal of Zionism is racism resolution that was passed in the UN. And then in the shift of discourse, that we no longer need to look at Zionism within that context, within the context of Jewish movements. That Zionism became the only articulation of what it is to be Jewish, and the only legitimate voice that can speak on the Middle East today, because it's the only European voice in the Middle East. So it really, the discourse needs to shift and to re-examine back why Israel is a Zionist state, why Israel is a Jewish-only state, and how does it perceive the indigenous people, and how does it perceive itself and the minorities within it.
Did you have a question over
here? Yeah, I wanted to say, do you see, think there is any influence on Israel from the United States, and how, you know, how the role of Zionism is relating to U.S. imperialism now?
I think that the there wouldn't be Israel is the only nuclear power in the Middle East today. There isn't a single Arab country that can stand in the face of Israel militarily. All of these weapons are coming from the United States. And there is an intersection of interest because the U.S. wants to maintain a dependent ally, not a dependable, but a dependent ally on the U.S. to use it militarily in order to maintain the flow of oil from the Middle East. Oil is the central focus of U.S. policy in the Middle East. They're about to attack Iraq soon, and the blueprint, the so-called blueprint, has just been leaked and released. Phase one of the war was Afghanistan, phase two is Palestine, phase three is Iraq. All phase one was Afghanistan in order to expand an oil pipe and generate jobs in Afghanistan, right, from Kazakhstan to the Arabian Sea. Phase two is in Palestine to eliminate any form of democratic or national resistance within the Arab world, at the fear that these regimes might become destabilized, the regimes loyal to the United States who maintain the flow of oil. And phase three is to eliminate the not-so-loyal regime, the one that the U.S. attacked before but did not overthrow, is to recolonize Iraq, basically. And so Israel represents that aircraft carrier for the U.S. militarily and politically.
Can I just stop for one second? Yes, I just want to give you a quick break also. I wanted to say there's a sign-in sheet being passed around. If you guys could sign up, we're, like I said earlier, we're the people, the organizers of this event are a group of students on campus who really want to build a kind of community of activists to get up for social change. And, you know, a lot of what you were saying about the United States being so largely involved in this is true for International May Day, and that the idea of the United States being involved in things that are going around the world, it holds true around the world. And as people living in the United States, we really have a responsibility to make our government accountable for what it does. And part of doing that is finding out, you know, what's going on in the world and what America, the American government, is doing in the world, and then it's acting on it. And so these teach-ins are an effort to, you know, put out that information, but it's also an effort to get people to act. So please sign up on the sign-in sheet. We're planning a month-long session of teach-ins next semester. And if you guys have any ideas, if you would like to see someone come and speak or any issues discussed, then please write it down on the sign-in sheet, and we will work on that. If you'd like to get involved, please sign up on the sign-in sheet and let us know. And also, the second part of that is, this is a grassroots kind of movement, and all of the flyers and everything has been coming out of our pockets. So I'm going to pass around a can, and if you guys could, you know, throw in a dollar or two or whatever you can, we'd really appreciate it. And
can I just say one little thing to that?
Yeah.
I just hope that next time, you know, when you guys are planning this for next fall or whatever it is, that you will actually try to be more educated, using different perspectives, not just hearing things that you already agree with, but maybe hearing things that you don't agree with already. So perhaps you can consider next time doing it as a debate style, as opposed to doing it just where, you know, one perspective is given.
Sure, we'd be very open to that, and that's part of the question. That's why we have such a big question and answer session also. But I'm very open to where
I think you would do a lot more. You know, have a lot more benefit on the people who you're trying to educate by.
Well, we can definitely do that, and if you put your information there, we can talk about that for sure.
Did you
assign
this?
No.
Because I think that's why there's no interaction, really, you know?
I agree. I fully agree.
And maybe I'll hear the question.
Yeah, can you hear me? I don't think sound's traveling this direction sometimes. Anyways, just my question is, if you could elaborate on how the UN resolution, what number was it? It's calling Zionism for racism, how that was overturned. Like, in who 3379, and what year was that overturned? And, like, what in what context was it overturned? What was going on? in the Middle East for that to change?
It was overturned under Boutros Boutros-Ghali in the 1990s, immediately after the Oslo Peace Accord was initiated. And it was after the defeat and the collapse of the Soviet Union that would have vetoed in the Security Council the overturn of that resolution, under the threat that the U.S. would cut aid to Russia if they would veto this resolution. I mean, there was that much U.S. backing for overturning that. I just want to add a little bit about the intersection of Israeli and American imperialist interests and the issues of discourse. I'll start with discourse. It is safe to say, I think, that the Palestinian voice and the progressive voice in general, the anti-imperialist voice in the United States, is completely underrepresented, censored, and silenced. And in particular, the Palestinian voice is censored and absent. When NPR reports on what's happening in the Middle East, they say every time a Palestinian gets killed, they say a Palestinian died in crossfire, or that there was some crossfire between the Church of the Nativity and the Israelis. Not that there are hostages that being hostages, meaning that the Israelis are threatening to kill them, who are surrounded in the Church of the Nativity and they're seeking refuge in there. And the Israelis have been continuously sniping, killing a person every 2 days out of the people who are imprisoned in the Church of the Nativity. No, NPR focuses on the fact, from their perspective, that there was crossfire and then there was shooting back and forth. So I don't think that the Israeli perspective or the American perspective on Israel, which is also the Israeli perspective, is being underrepresented, so that every time a Palestinian speaks or the voice of the oppressed gets heard, that you have to have an oppressor to reaffirm and to reassert the language of dominance and the language of power in a manner that is completely consistent with U.S. interest, as has been propagated through the media. That's the first thing. Secondly, in terms of intersection of imperialism, which is also related to the first topic of discourse, is that Israel has supported and trained the regime in Guatemala. They have conducted... The reason why Resolution 3379, 1975, was passed was mainly because Israel was helping the apartheid state of Israel, of South Africa, to test nuclear weapons at the time. And they were conducting joint tests of nuclear weapons. And the United Nations found that extremely dangerous and extremely destabilizing for the world community to have a regime like South Africa and a regime like Israel holding nuclear weapons. And that's why the resolution was passed.
Well, I was wondering about the... I got in a debate with someone who was pro-Israeli. He's a pretty wealthy investor. Mm-hmm. He swims here at the gymnasium. He says that when Israel first came into existence in 1948, I think the UN... Maybe you already discussed this because I'm late, but anyway, the UN partitioned that region half-half, I think, and that as soon as the state of Israel came into existence, the Arab states... attacked Israel and tried to drive the Israelis into the sea. And I'm not too familiar with the history, but I didn't think that was correct, but I thought maybe you might. And also another question, if you don't mind. I think the Palestinians are Islamic, I'm not sure. And I was wondering what significance does Jerusalem have to the Islamic faith?
Let me remind people that Jesus Christ himself is Palestinian, not in the national contemporary sense, but he's from that area.
He's also Jewish.
And yes. He's also Jewish, correct.
One body, one
vote. Correct. And the whole of Christianity was started from that area. Some of the most ancient Christian beliefs are still held in that area, and they're held among Palestinians, among Assyrians, among others. So the media has been lately, in this war against Islam and this portrayal of Muslims as terrorists, has been trying to position the conflict as that of Jew against Muslim. And as that particularly of European Jew, who's civilized, who's closer to us as Americans, against this extremist, irrational Muslim fundamentalist who wants to attack modernity and attack civilization. And that's why they portray all Palestinians as Muslims. There's a large portion of the Palestinian people who are Christians. And in fact, if you notice the actions of the Israeli government during the last Intifada, the first bombing that the Israelis conducted against Palestinian areas, Palestinian civilian areas, were against Christian areas. Because in the Israeli mind, the Christian connection to Palestine is a lot more dangerous than the Muslim connection to Palestine, because that's alienating to the European and the American powers. Mm-hmm. And so there has been a campaign not only to claim that Palestinians are Muslims, that they're all monolithic Muslims, but also to depopulate the Christian villages. And that happened in Beit Sahur, Beit Hanina, Beit Jala, all of these areas, Bethlehem, right? Mm-hmm. All of these areas that have high concentrations of Christians. Your other question about the establishment of the state and the partition of Palestine. The way Palestine was partitioned was to give basically 22% to the Palestinians. And that partitioning took hold and materialized in 1967 after the Six-Day War. But it was proposed initially in 1917 by Lord Balfour, that I mentioned earlier, to give all the fertile regions to a minority of the population, and that was a Jewish immigrant minority that constituted about 10%, and to give all the arid regions that constitute to the indigenous people that constituted 90%. And it is for that reason that Palestinians at the time rejected the partition plan. And so if you look at the coastal region, the western Palestine, those are the most fertile areas.
Well, I guess I have two questions. One, okay, you were talking about how the Israel supported the Guatemalan regime. I was wondering about, say, in the 70s and the 80s when they had the dirty wars in South American countries. I understand that Israel was supporting a lot of these little fascist regimes, including Argentina, some of whom were anti-Semitic as well, or had Nazi connections.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Israel participated in the Iran-Contra scandal, where it channeled money to the Contras after the United States passed a law to stop the flow of money. Israel participated in supporting the Guatemalan regime against the indigenous people over there, and participated in the help and the training of the Guatemalan government. Today, they're participating in the training of the paramilitary in Colombia, and conducting some of the flow of intelligence over against the FARC and the indigenous rebels over there, and so on. It is not too much of a surprise that that's the case, because there is a whole intelligence institution that has been built by the U.S. And in order to pay back the subsidies of the U.S., when the U.S. asks for Israel to do these favors that are politically difficult for the American government, Israel has to step in and get involved.
Just going back with between the relationship between apartheid South Africa and Israel, was it just some sort of like just a natural relationship they had because they were both colonizers and racist regimes, or I mean, what else was behind that kind of relationship?
If you look at the advent of the non-allied movement, started by Indira Gandhi and Jamal Abdel Nasser, and it took a very strong position against racism worldwide. That really influenced even the latest UN conference against racism. If you were an Indian national, for example, at the time, immediately after decolonization, your passport would have said it's valid all over the world except in South Africa and Israel. And that's where they both started seeing common interests, that in order to position themselves and maintain control and hegemony against their perceived sea of savages around them, the white population saw the black population around it as a sea of savage, and the Israeli population saw the Arabs around them as these dangerous people that needed to be expelled and oppressed and so on. They started forming common economic interests, common military projects, and linking to the United States. So much of the Botha establishment was actually subsidized by the CIA. The flow of diamonds, the De Beers industry. Diamonds flowed out of South Africa and into Israel. They were cut by the Israelis and then shipped to Holland and elsewhere for finishing. So there were very tight and intimate economic and military ties between the two regimes because of the world rejection of such establishment, of such institutions of racism. Yet in the United States, that has become normalized. That South Africa at the time was fighting communism, right? And Nelson Mandela was a terrorist who belonged on Robben Island. And today, Palestinians are the terrorists. And mainly because that serves the American interest.
How do you feel about one state versus two state solutions?
I think that it's not really up to me to feel anything about it. I think the reality is, in my analysis, that a two-state solution is not a solution. It cannot work for two reasons. One, Israel has constructed so many settlements in violation of international law in the 1967 territories, starting from the Oslo Accord until today, which is from 1993 until today, that equate to the number of settlements that were started from 1967 until 1993. So today, one out of every five Jewish nationals, the Israeli definition of what a Jewish national is, lives outside of the Green Line, whether in Jerusalem, whether in the so-called suburbs of Jerusalem, that extend all the way up to Jericho, basically, because that's the plan of expansion. So, if you're constructing a two-state solution, according to 242 and 338 UN resolutions, you have to give the Palestinians 22% of historic Palestine and give the Israelis 78%. What are you going to do 20 years from now when there is demographic parity between the Palestinians carrying the Israeli passport and the Jewish citizens of Israel? What are you going to do with the refugees? What are you going to do with the massive inequality due to dispossession and due to oppression over the years? So you will provide an incremental solution, meaning that, yes, the Palestinians will be able to assert their own will on part of the land, but it's only one quarter of the Palestinian population that's doing that. You still have three quarters of the Palestinian population that have not been addressed, and you still have a racist state that's been established to serve its definition of what nationals are.
First of all, like Middle East isn't just Islamic Arabs. There's other people there. For example, Persian people aren't Arabs, mm-hmm. and you know, by tradition, we're Zoroastrian people. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to know. Israeli people, like, I know people who identify themselves as Israelis. I was wondering what their ethnic background is. Like, people who are indigenous to that region, but, you know, like, identify themselves as Israeli. Are they just Palestinian Jews, traditionally, or...?
There have been Palestinian Jews, but they're a very small minority of the Jewish state. what exists today in Israel is a huge influx from Europe.
But like there are Israeli people who are indigenous to that region, but identify with like the term Israeli, because I know they live here now. But you know, what's
Okay, the construction of the state is that you have Ashkenazi Jews that are European, you have Sephardic Jews that are Western European and Moroccan, you have Mizrahi Jews that are Arabs, like Iraqis, Yemenis, people from North Africa, from Egypt, so on, and people from Palestine. The Jewish people from Palestine themselves, because there was such a huge influx from all over the world, constitute a tiny minority of the immigrant population. So, how are they treated within Israel, those indigenous Jewish people, Jewish Palestinians? They're treated the same way Mizrahi Jews are treated, which are, they have to reject their Arab language and begin speaking Hebrew. They have to reject their Arab heritage. So even though they may have served in the army, they have done everything that any other European Jew has done, yet they're still treated as a perceived threat, because at any moment they may turn Arab, right? They may begin identifying themselves as Arab. The other point that I wanted to address is the term Middle East. I think Middle East is a very dangerous term. It's a colonial term that positions, and it's a flexible term. I mean, today, you know, they're about to add India to the Middle East. Afghanistan is in the Middle East, right? Every day it expands further and further east, because it's centered around Europe, where China and Japan are the Far East, the Middle East is close to Europe. So the way I would identify the region is that anything that's around the Mediterranean is the Mediterranean region. It's the Arab world. It's historically been the Arab world. There is Iran, and there's everything else, you know, as within its own historical and cultural entity, outside the ethnocentric European definition of what Middle East is. And I think that term truly needs to be rejected. And Israel perpetuates that term quite a bit, because it, again, in its assertion of an alternative narrative, it tries to assert itself as indigenous to the region, instead of saying Arab world and Israel.
I'm sorry, because I came in late from China, that kind of stuff. But I just wanted to ask you when he was asking about the one state and two state solution. One, I was curious about why you said that it wasn't for you to have an opinion. I'm just curious. And then the other thing is, if I know this is probably a really hard thing to do, but it made sense to me what you were saying about the two-state solution, why it doesn't work with all the inequalities. And so if you could you like outline how the one-state solution, how that could work for actually addressing the inequalities?
Yeah. I didn't say I don't have an opinion.
Oh.
He said, how do you feel about it? I said, how I feel about it is irrelevant, because I'm not setting the terms here. The one-state solution is, if you define it as one-state solution, as a solution in itself, I think can be taken out of context. What you need to look at is the Jewish-only character of a colonial state constructed on Palestine. That Jewish-only character needs to be secularized. It needs to be transformed into something that's democratic and secular, and organic, and part of the historical continuity and the continuous development of the region, where Jews and Palestinians have equal rights. And it's simple as that. And the way to achieve that is that you give the Palestinians a right of return. Mm-hmm. The 5.5 million people who have been pushed into exile in 1948 and 1967.
I was thinking about the peace plan that was advocated by the bodies. I was wondering why Bush accepted that. And do you think that that would work at all to solve the problem?
The peace plan that was proposed by the Saudis neglected to mention the right of return. That's why Bush accepted it. And it's a huge compromise. Well, I have a question, and maybe different people can answer it. My hope today was truly to start establishing a new form of discourse around Israel and how it relates to the United States and its underlying ideology and culture from the perspective of the oppressed people over there. My first question is, how do people see the work needs to be done in terms of the unique American role and the unique responsibility that the progressives in America have in support of the Palestinian people and in the reversal of these years and years of colonization and racism? And my second question is, you know, every time a Palestinian or an Arab articulates this position, you know, you get to hear the argument that we need to hear the other side that's being currently overrepresented and so on. And yet, we still feel that we're truly not heard enough. What kind of work can we do to try to bring a new form of consciousness around the issue of the ideology that's underpinning Israel itself? So my hope is to start a little bit of discussion about it, because I answered a lot of questions and I talked a lot, so maybe I can learn too.
Yeah, I'll respond to that. First of all, I want to thank the people that put this on. This has been really informative for me. I feel like I've learned a lot. And I certainly feel like I've heard enough of what you called the NPR, you know, perspective, the pro-imperialist perspective. And I feel like the spirit of this teaching has been similar to that of the demonstrations that took place about 3 weeks ago on 19th Avenue, which I think there was like over 600 people there. You know, the occupation is wrong. We're against the occupation. We should stop USA to Israel. And I think that as people living here, we have, you know, a big role to play in, you know, pushing that argument forward. And, you know, not because if the U.S., you know, wasn't funding the State of Israel that it could be an objective peacemaker, but that, you know, the U.S. interests are not in having peace in that region, but, you know, maintaining, like, control over the oil and that sort of thing, which you mentioned. And that if we stopped USAID to Israel, you know, that would help the Palestinians militarily. And they're a colonized people, and they have the right to fight back militarily so they can win their national liberation. And I really think that it's just going to take, you know, getting together in you know, setups like this and just having discussions and also getting out there and just doing the day-to-day organizing, you know, getting involved with different organizations. And just doing it at the grassroots level, because I certainly don't think we're ever going to influence NPR to put our voices out there. We just got to, you know, do it day by day.
Well, first, our first question about how I know we can change American policy, well, in general, I guess that has to do to change American society in, you know, the way it's just structured now, you know, to the American, you know, white, there's white privilege or a certain group of white people, and then there's, you know, the big gap between rich and poor, and sorry, we have to make change in American society. And then there's American foreign policy, which has been to support really reactionary forces, really fascist forces overseas to maintain their power, and we would have to change that, and we need to change that over here. And that's the what they've been supporting in Israel is part of that. And then also, another thing that has to be addressed in the matter of Israel and the Jewish-only state is that the reason people supported Jewish state, they felt that there were, the Jews had no home and that they needed to have a place that was their own, so where they could feel safe and they could belong, a place where they could always go if they faced persecution somewhere else. I think it's like, I know the Palestinians aren't responsible for anti-Semitism, but it's still important for for people to speak up in support of Palestine to make it clear that they're not anti-Jewish and that they're also for the rights of the Jews, that, you know, to address those concerns.
Go ahead, no. Okay, I just wanted to, I wasn't here for the whole thing, and but I just wanted to add the fact off of what you were saying, that it's not that Palestinians don't want a homeland for Jewish people. We just don't want a place for Jewish only. You know what I mean? It's just that racist dichotomy that excludes everybody who's native to that land or who hasn't left in 1948 or et cetera, et cetera. So I just think it's not a matter of not wanting a place for Jews to feel safe, because of course that's what we want. We're not in for the persecution of Jews. It's not what it's about, and I'm sure you had touched on it, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's all I want to say.
Oh, just, I was just thinking about, it seems like there's so many parallels with the South African system that, I'm not probably as caught up as I should be about how that's going now, but there seems to have been a big change in South Africa, and that there was international pressure played some part in that, and so I would be interested in finding out more about how people in the U.S. organize to defeat that as a way to see, like, I know divestment was something that happened a lot there and that's being talked about now.
Exactly. I think that, as the sister mentioned before she left, that there continue to be problems in South Africa, but the end of apartheid was a huge incremental step forward that truly opened up new horizons for the African civil society to begin organizing, to begin working on redistribution of wealth, to begin reversing some of the theft of the beers that was responsible for the establishment of apartheid. And I think that came because of the international solidarity movement that boycotted all South African institutions. While the United States supports Israel with $6 billion a year, the private sector in the United States supports Israel with $40 billion a year. So the private sector is an extraordinary institution that's being subsidized by your money in the academic institutions, in the retirement accounts. So a divestment campaign is in order here. And I think a divestment campaign in the U.S. is a lot more effective against Israel than it was against South Africa, because most of the money flows from the U.S. You have venture capital funds that are taking military establishments like Checkpoint Software, for example. Can you believe it? There was a company called Checkpoint Software that operates in the Silicon Valley. The purpose of Checkpoint Software was to establish the magnetic identity card to identify you as a Palestinian, as a non-Jew. And today, Checkpoint Software is one of the largest builders of databases here in the Silicon Valley that has taken a military technology with its encryption, with its security codes, and has popularized it. So the fact that this company can operate in the Silicon Valley is a slap in the face against everybody who's progressive. That is an atrocity in itself. And that needs to be reversed. And there are a lot of things that can be done by the progressive community here. So we're really calling for a three-faceted campaign. One is to end all aid to Israel, as somebody suggested. The most effective part is the divestment from the Israeli institutions. And then the third one is to boycott all Israeli products until apartheid is gone, not only within the occupied areas, but also until Israel is truly transformed from a Jewish-only state to a democratic state where all of its citizens, not just nationals, but all of its citizens are treated equally.
Keep talking about South Africa, and I totally see how it's related and parallel to the struggle of Palestinians and, in their land. But I just keep thinking of Native Americans and
what the United States government did to Native Americans in this very country. And, like, I feel we need to realize that this is the same struggle. I mean, we are all united in that. This has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. And, I don't know, in order to really, I feel like we need to be neutral, totally, like, open-eared, open-eyed, questioning everything. And then we'll see, you know, if, like, we really follow our hearts. Like, there's only one side, you know? I mean, as a human being, I feel that struggle, you know? And it's not about being Jewish or being Arab or being, you know, anything else. It's about being a human being and seeing the destruction that, you know, these great powers have had on humanity, on what is good. We are all a part of that, you know? And I don't know, in order to really get that, we need to talk. You know, forums like these are great, but we need to take it out to the streets and not be scared to talk to people about it. It's like, we might have differences, and that's great, but I respect you as a human being, you know? And, like, I mean, if we can't even have that, you know, just, like, to see that we're all the same in that one aspect, you know? Like, there's no resolution possible. We have to have that common ground. And, like, I'm scared to talk to a lot of people about this because I feel like, you know, I will be pretty much attacked for my beliefs. And that's not right, you know? Like, that's...
Let me recommend a few books for people who are interested in learning more about the topic also. Mainly because... once you begin talking about the morality of the issue, because it stands on its own feet, the Zionist agenda has been, thank you so much, the Zionist agenda in the United States has been to label you as anti-Semitic. If you criticize Israel, you're anti-Semitic. If you're Jewish and you're anti-Zionist, then you're a self-hating Jew. They actually coined the term of self-hating Jew for anybody who opposes Israel for what it stands for, because it's speaking in their name, it's implementing these policies, it's using the Holocaust to justify the another atrocity that's beginning to open up into something that's much bigger. So, just to, in order to have the facts, I recommend Edward Said, The Question of Palestine. Said, S-A-I-D. Simha Flapan, F-L-A-P-P-A-N. Simha Flapan, S-I-M-H-A, Flapan, F-L-A-P-P-A-N. The Creation of the State.
The Creation of the State?
Mm-hmm. Myth and Fact is the subtitle. Another one is Uri Davis. These are two Israeli scholars, Simcha Flapan, and Uri Davis is also an Israeli scholar. Israel's Apartheid. And then a local Palestinian scholar here who's written great essays, is George Bisharat. You can download his essays off of the internet on the legal constitution, not constitution, in, because Israel doesn't have a constitution, but the legal formation of Israeli racism.
Can you spell his name?
B-I-S-H-A-R-A-T. He teaches at Hastings Law School. But you know, you will be called names because this whole attempt is an attempt of censoring any voice that will speak for justice, any voice that will speak against U.S. and Israeli interests. Because ultimately, this is an American-Israeli war against the Palestinians.
Yeah, just a question for you. I know we kind of went past that stage, but I wanted to put it for you, though. What do you feel is the role of student activists in this country as allies of Palestine?
I think the role is twofold. One is to get the Palestinian voice to penetrate through the censorship and through the obstacles of censoring us. We don't have to have an opposing viewpoint every time we speak, though we would be glad to debate. I mean, it's not like our issues are not powerful enough that they stand alone morally and legally. But our voices need to be heard. The voices of the refugees, the voices of the survivors of massacres. Bring people over from Palestine, from Jenin. Have them come and speak about their experiences. Let people know what the magnitude of the atrocity. That's the first thing. And I think secondly is to work on material aid. So much of this is going out of your tuition fees to the university and your tax dollars. And so you need to research where the university is investing its money. Is it investing its money in American companies that are doing business in Israel, in Israeli companies? What's really happening here with your money? And if it is, you need to cut that money off so that you're not subsidizing. Because now you know, you have the responsibility now to act. And that is, how can you cut the flow of money in subsidizing this kind of atrocity and maintaining a regime of apartheid?
I went to a talk that the Jewish woman gave, and she showed slides of the country there. She showed how that country was, like the Israelis had highways that were supposed to be used only by them, and how the area was divided into islands, that the Palestinians had to use dirt roads to get from one island to the next. Mm-hmm. And she was part of a really progressive liberal group, and she had she showed slides of her Arab friends, and she took, it was really a lot of courage for her to go the roadblocks and to really carry signs and to she was really protesting the against the Zionist government. So there's a group of Israeli Jews that are really, about 15 or 20% that are really progressive and liberal, and they're for the Palestinians. And so I don't think that should be forgotten. And somehow the progressive groups here have to sort of link, I think, or they, apparently their voices aren't being heard by the government at all.
No, they're not. But I think it's also important to link with the progressive groups in Palestine also who are doing similar work, because those are the ones who need the help as much as possible.
I kind of think we're bringing this up because I think that that gets thrown around so much unnecessarily, like the idea of, like, is it anti-Jewish or is it just anti-Israeli? And obviously, it's clear to me from working, or from just starting to learn more and more about this, that it's not, like Helia was saying, it's not like if you're anti-Israeli, you're anti-Jewish. I mean, it doesn't make sense. What the Israelis are doing is just part of, and what the U.S. is supporting the Israelis in doing is obviously a system of oppression. So that's clear to me. But some of the stuff that, some of the signs and stuff, and obviously, all kinds of people come out to a rally, and not every sign represents what everyone else thinks. But I'm just trying to think of ways, because I know certain times people bring up things and they're like, well, that seems anti-Jewish, like a certain symbol. When there's the Star of David, which is a symbol of the Israeli government, which they're co-opting, but it's also a symbol of a religion. How do you address that issue? And I mean, how do you respond to that and not fall into the trap of making it a sort of Jewish Arab conflict or whatever, when that doesn't seem like what it really is? I'm just trying to think of kind of how to address that to myself and to other people that question that.
I think that's an excellent question. It's a very important question. Do you want to answer? Or do you want me to?
Well, I just want to.
Go ahead.
I'll just take a stab at it.
Yeah.
I think for Jewish people, I mean, right now it's like, I don't know if it's necessarily know if the Zionists are the majority of Jews, but it's clear that they're the loudest voice amongst Jews. They put out the loudest line. And if, so, in a lot of, for Palestinians and people who support Palestinians, if they keep on, especially for Palestinians, they understand that the Jews or the Zionists are doing this for the, in the name of Judaism,
right,
this oppression of the Palestinian people. So I think it's the interest, it's in the interest for Jewish people to say not in our name, because that's creating the anti-Semitism against all Jewish people, the fact that the Zionists are doing it on behalf of the Jews. So that's really why Jewish people need to get out, come up, and they need to speak out and say not in our name. And this is like, I mean, like what the Zionists are doing in Palestine just completely goes against the whole like religion of Judaism. I mean, it goes against any like type of whatever religion you want to pick. I mean, like there's certain moral things that all religions share, and it's completely immoral what's going on. And I mean, so it's totally within the interest of Jewish people to take that to that stance.
Yeah, I think one needs to understand also the eyes of the victimized and what the victimized sees, what the victim sees in the process of trying to assert their own liberation and their own humanity. From the Palestinian perspective, what they see is concentration camps.
Right.
They just opened up another one that has been closed for several years in the Negev desert. These camps that are nicely, the euphemism for them is prison camps, right? These camps, like Marwan Barghouti, who's one of the leaders of the resistance, who was just captured, he was not allowed to sleep for about 4 days in a row as part of torture, and who knows what else is happening to him. But this is one very famous person who's got that protection because he's very famous. Just imagine that, the thousands of people. There are about 5,500 people that people don't know anything about. They've completely disappeared. So there is a use of something that's reminiscent of Nazism, such as the use of concentration camps, such as the use of collective punishment, the use of massacres, the use of displacement. So when the victimized comes forward and says, what I'm seeing here is something that's reminiscent of Nazism, that's not necessarily an indictment of everybody. What this is, it's attracting your attention for you to go out there and recruit the voices, as Nabil said, the voices who need to step forward and assert their identity and dissociate themselves from Zionism. Mm-hmm. We need, in this country, a strong Jewish organization that says we're anti-Zionist. Mm-hmm. And that is really essential in order to avoid any further degradation and regression in this form of discourse that's shifting away from the fundamentals of apartheid and into criticism of Israeli policy. Even many of these progressive groups in Israel only discuss the issue of occupation because they want to maintain the model that Rabin discussed, and that is to maintain the character of his state and the character of his Knesset. We need something more fundamental than that, and that's really important in order to have a large shift. And I think a starting point is not to position yourself as anti-Israeli. We're not anti-anybody. As the sister said, you know, in order to be in solidarity with the indigenous people in the United States, that doesn't mean that you're anti-everybody else. You're in solidarity with them. You want their rights to materialize. You want them to live as free people, as equals. And so to be against racism or against apartheid or to deconstruct and criticize Zionism for what it is, for that was responsible for the construction of the state, is to be pro something. Mm-hmm. And that's really pro universal humanity. So shifting the language and paying very close attention that your starting point is not where you were pushed to be. Because they told you that if you're pro-Palestinian, you're anti-Israel. And so, you know, we begin to internalize that we're anti-Israel and Israel is in the center and we're all satellites. Just, you know, it's the norm. No, Israel is not the norm. The same way South Africa was not the norm. Mm-hmm. So I think the two are very much linked in your question.
I just want to say, I know that there are some Jewish sects like, who are very religious or orthodox, that means they do everything the way they said in the Torah, who are also against the establishment of the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm. And they're getting louder these days. They were very visible in D.C. in the 100,000 person march.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were extremely visible there.
Well, I kind of wanted to go back to what you said, Helena, because I think you made a really, really good and important comment in terms of talking about, okay, talking to people that we know in our lives or in our classes or whatever around the issue of Palestine and Israel. And sometimes you can get into really good conversations where people, you can win people to the side of the Palestinians. Sometimes they're really confusing. Sometimes they're really bad. And I think if you do it by yourself and you just see it as yourself as an individual activist going out and doing it on your own, it's very easy to feel atomized, to feel like you're just kind of, you know, you're out there in the wilderness by yourself if you don't have a group to bring it back to. So I'm not here to, like, propose any kind of group, but it seems like organization is really important for two aspects, for what, you know, you were talking about in terms of being able to communicate to other people and convince other people or reach out to people that are already, you know, for, you know, freedom for Palestinians, and also for education, for, like, events, bringing speakers, having, you know, study groups, stuff like that. I mean, I know we're in school and we study all the time, but, like, we're not taught this stuff here. Like, it's amazing. Like, before I became politically involved in San Francisco, like, I considered myself a pretty smart person, but I knew nothing about Palestine, absolutely nothing. It wasn't until I became an activist and actually did reading on my own outside of school that I learned anything about Zionism. I could not tell you what Zionism was, and I think there are a lot of people out there that are like that, you know, so like, I don't have any formal proposal, but it seems like being organized is really important in that process. And having some kind of way to reach out to other people.
Yeah, I'm sure the students here at GUPS can tell you a lot about some of their activities and actions. But you also may want to think about starting something on the solidarity level outside of GUPS, where GUPS, you know, works, General Union of Palestine Students works with everybody else, like the model that they have at Berkeley, for example.
So,
Students for Justice in Palestine.
But here we have Students for Peace. Yeah. But I actually think that's just something to think about. I mean, I think that's a good idea. Because, like, in Students for Peace, we're focused on the war, the worldwide, you know, war, which will move to us. So I think, like, talking about some organization like that.
They've actually come to some of our GUPS meeting, and we've been trying to open the doors kind of within the organization to that type of thing as far as study groups and different events that we're kind of working on right now for this semester and next semester and stuff. So definitely, and we have an open connection.
And with the whole lifelong education thing too.
Yeah, so that's kind of our main goal, is just trying to get more of a coalition, more organized group. I mean, I think what you're saying is so true. There's so many little groups that are doing little things, and I think that if we all come together to work on what our issues are, I mean, of course, each group, you know, or different groups have different ideologies, and there's not a problem with that, but there are certain issues that are, you know, at the core, and if we can all come together and work on those, you know, that'd be great, and that's why we're having these.
And like this discussion also, I think it's also important to shift the discourse from Zionism as racism to Zionism as a racist settler colonial movement. Because Zionism is a lot more than racism. It's a lot harsher than racism in so many ways. And because that also exposes how Israel is constructed.
It's like, just to point out, like, some of, like, the education that needs to go out there, like, me and a fellow activist, we were making some signs for one of our events. So one of the signs we were painting was Zionism is racism. And this guy comes up to us and he's like, "What do you have against Rastafarianism?"
Against what?
Rastafarianism. Because Rasta used the different stuff.
Are there any more questions?
Comments?
Would you like to give a closing?
Well, I just would like to say thank you for everybody who's been putting a lot of hard work here at SF State. It's been very, very difficult for many of us in these times to organize, not only because of the censorship, but also because there is a concerted effort to make it very difficult for us to even have a room, put together a protest. There has been assaults on our civil liberties by the government, assaults on our liberties by the institutions that we work for or where we go to school. And my hope is to have the people outside of the Palestinian caucus to recognize how much risk and effort the Palestinians are taking here in order to make something possible like this event and having this dialogue and discussion. And my hope is also some of the Jewish colleagues and the Jewish organizations that are organized to think about this discourse, take it back, re-examine the monolithic or unilateral perspective of how Zionism has been viewed and how it's been used as an indoctrinating ideology in order to really crush dissent and critique of Israel and make it almost blasphemous to criticize the state of Israel for its actions. Just remember, you know, there is no state that is above the law, and there is no state that doesn't make mistakes. And questioning authority is truly the first step towards critical thinking. And I think Israel needs to be questioned in that sense. So that's all I have.